Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The title of this talk is Why So Sad? The Sorrows That Kill and the Sorrows That Save. Before I launch into any of the specific content, I wanted to commend you on showing up for a talk with a very complicated title. I'm always aware, whenever I'm giving a talk, that most of the people who show up didn't have to show up. And when I'm speaking, I have a mild background curiosity about why each person who came, came. And although it would be easier for me to ask each of you right now why you came, I'm going to take a more complicated route and tell you why I think you might have come if the title of this talk had been one of the earlier, simpler versions that I was considering. If you had shown up to Acedia, the sorrow that kills, dun, 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 you would have known that Acedia is something bad, and you would have come to the talk to figure out whether you had that bad thing, and if you had it, how to get away from it. If you had shown up to the talk, St. Thomas on the Problem of Pain, you would have come either because you misread pain as evil and you're interested in the problem of evil, or because you find problems to be irresistible opportunities to look for solutions, and you're curious to work out a solution to the problem of pain. If you'd showed up to St. Thomas on Sorrow as the solution to the problem of pain, you would have been disappointed to have been told the solution, but you would have come wanting to know in what way sorrow saves. My hope, now that I have suggested all these motives to you, is that you've adopted each of them, more or less, and that you'll hold you here, at least until you recognize their answers or solutions in the three parts of the talk that I'll start giving once I stop pretending to psychoanalyze you. But before I tell you what those parts are, let me mention that my motive for this talk is primarily practical. This is to say, I'll present a Thomistic account of sorrow in general and of acedia in particular, with a view to underscoring what we can do in case we should happen to find ourselves sorrowful in one of these ways. Accordingly, in part one, I'll identify what sorrow is in general. In part two, I'll look at the particular kind of sorrow that's called acedia. And in part three, I'll propose some practical things that we can do in response to the sorrows that show up in our experience. And just so I don't have to say this at every turn, all of what follows is Thomistic rather than straight up Thomas. I'm striving to be faithful to what Thomas says without being unhelpfully faithful to the scholastic way that he says it. But as a warning, one of the scholastic practices that I will follow is to hang my comments in every part on questions. And then I'll try to ask questions in the order in which they can be reasonably answered, rather than the order in which they first occur. So, part one, what is sorrow? But first, there are two other questions that we ought to answer if we're going to be as orderly as St. Thomas. The first prelude question is, do we really need to ask this question? And then the second is, if we do need to ask it, how should we go about answering it? Taking the first, isn't it enough for us to say, you felt sad, right? It's that. There are a few reasons why that won't work, and all of these reasons point to the fact that there are many barriers in our experience to our becoming aware both of what sorrow is and even whether we're experiencing sorrow. I'll list three. Barrier one to our becoming aware of sorrow is life is complex. The complexity gets more complex in a culture of efficiency. We have lots to do, or at least we feel as though we have lots to do. And being focused on getting things done reduces our ability to be aware of being sad. Barrier two to our becoming aware of sorrow is that human beings are complex. We're complex because we're attracted to many things and in many ways. We're attracted to physical things, like pictures of really buff cardinals that are also somehow cyclones. And then also to the non-physical aspects of things, like tasteful expressions of local pride. Some of our attractions are based on an accurate understanding of the thing's goodness, and some things aren't. For example, the first time that I heard of or had hollandaise sauce, I was overwhelmed by its tastiness. And at that meal, I ate nothing except hollandaise sauce. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, I want this for every meal. But after the meal, I asked the cook what was in it, and I was horrified that I had just eaten an entire stick of butter. So, my attraction to this, when I understood what it was at least mitigated. Our attractions can also be either proportionate or disproportionate to how good the thing is in its own right. So, for example, the conversation at the table where I was chowing down on hollandaise sauce was objectively a better thing than the hollandaise sauce, but I was more attracted to the hollandaise than to the conversation. The point of running through all these complex attractions or loves that we have is this. There are as many ways of being sad or sorrowful as there are of being attracted and delighted. Barrier three to our awareness of sorrow is that emotions themselves are complex. Unless you've taken a serious look at what you call sorrow, aversion, pain, despair, and even fear and anger, it's very likely that you'll at some point call one emotion by the name of another. To put it in technical terms, the passions aren't mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive, and some of them are lookalikes for the others. It's hard to tell, for example, whether you're eating Ben and Jerry's out of anger that someone stole your bike, or out of sorrow that the bike, which you loved, is now gone. The answer is probably both. So, at least because of the complexity of life, the complexity of human attraction, and the complexity of the emotions, the answer to the question, what is sorrow, isn't obvious. How then should we go about asking the question, what is sorrow? Thomas's way of answering questions is to point to three things. He points first to the causes of something, second to its effects, and then third to its remedies. I will follow Thomas's approach, but with one addition, in order to prevent us from zoning out too much. I'll ask Tristan to demonstrate for us what it looks like to be sorrowful. Tristan is going to be our go-to model for this talk, both because his name sounds like Latin for sorrow, tristitia, also because he lives next to a neighbor whose pit bull is named Dolores, which is Latin for pain, and because he happens to be a pretty emotionally expressive guy. The thing that Tristan enjoys most in life is running. He lives to run. Suppose we catch him starting off in his neighborhood training for a half marathon. Excuse me, I just skipped a whole page. No, I didn't. Suppose we catch him starting off in his neighborhood training for a half marathon. As he passes by his neighbor's house, he notices that Dolores, the pit bull, has started running toward him. When Dolores succeeds in running over the electric fence, Tristan is filled with fear. This fear helps Tristan to run faster, and it also helps him to leap over a wooden fence. Unfortunately, the fear doesn't help Tristan to fall gracefully. He lands on his ankle and experiences pain. Initially, Tristan holds out hope that his ankle hasn't been sprained, but only bruised. He tries to walk on it, but finding the walking excruciating, he despairs of escaping the pain. So, in order to distract himself from sorrowing over the pain, he becomes angry, first at his neighbor for buying a pit bull, then at God for creating pit bulls, and then finally at himself for landing so clumsily. When the angry rant gets old, Tristan realizes that he won't be able to compete, and sorrow washes over him. In a less charming but more straightforward manner, here are a few things to note about sorrow and the other emotions that Tristan just demonstrated. First, note that neither sorrow nor any other emotion is an action or a decision. We can act upon an emotion, but the emotion itself is only a spontaneous response to some perception. It's a response that St. Thomas calls an inclination. It's one thing to want to eat my neighbor's hamburger, and it's another thing to actually do it. A second thing to note is that sorrow is both similar to and different from joy. They're similar in that both of these are activities of resting rather than moving. Neither joy nor sorrow goes anywhere. Or, if it goes anywhere, it goes around in the same circle. Joy and sorrow are different, however, in that joy is a kind of resting with the presence of something that's good, whereas sorrow is a kind of resting with the presence of something that is evil. Or, we could say, resting with the absence of some good. A third thing to note is that sorrow is both similar to and different from pain. They're similar in that both pain and sorrow are a response to the absence of some good. But they're different in that pain is merely the sensible awareness of something evil. Animals clearly have this. Sorrow, on the other hand, is an intellectual awareness of some evil. Sorrow usually arises when we are aware that we are being in pain. Lastly, note that sorrow is similar to but different from both fear and anger. They're similar in that sorrow, fear, and anger all involve our attention to something that's evil. They're different in that fear and anger make us move, respectively, away from that evil thing or toward that evil thing. Whereas with sorrow, there's no movement. And this is because we have no hope either of escape or of victory. Gathering these together, we might say that sorrow is the resting of the heart in response to resting our attention on some pain. The causes of sorrow, then, are pain and awareness. What's required for pain differs from what's required for awareness. In order to be in pain, two conditions have to be fulfilled. First, we have to desire something that's good. Second, that good has to be absent in a way that appears to us to be definitive. It's not merely an approaching absence, but one that's already here. The good that's absent can be something physical or not merely physical. So, for example, if you bite into a cookie that's noticeably undercooked, your senses can be aware of the absence of appropriately moist cookies. Similarly, though, when you realize that it's you who noticeably overcooked those cookies, there's an absence of what you understand to be good, not merely what your senses recognize to be good. In order to be aware of pain, either of these kinds, only one condition needs to be fulfilled. You have to allow yourself to feel the pain. And you do this by not distracting yourself, by attending to other things. This is to say, you become aware of pain by not directing your attention to some other cheerful thing. We might call this busyness. By not fighting the pain in some sort of anger. And by not fleeing the pain by doing things out of fear. When the two causes of sorrow are present, namely pain and awareness, we experience its effects, or we might say its expressions, in different ways. The expression of sorrow in the body shows up as a lack of readiness to move. Contemporary psychology would call this probably the activation of the parasympathetic system. Here, there's a lack of adrenaline and dopamine, which are appropriate for motion. The expression of sorrow in the heart, or Thomas would say in the appetite, which is to say the desiring part of us, the expression of sorrow in the heart also shows up as a lack of readiness to move. And then finally, the expression of sorrow in our external movements shows up, unsurprisingly, as a lack of movement. St. Thomas mentions among his remedies for sorrow that taking baths helps. We'll hold off on discussing his more robust remedies until part three and move on to part two. What is acedia? As before, let's ask Thomas's two prelude questions here. First, do we really have to ask this question? Isn't it enough to say that acedia is a sorrow just over a very particular object? Like, there's sorrow over sprained ankles, there's sorrow over giving a tedious talk, and then there's sorrow over my friendship with God. That last is a short way of accounting for acedia in Thomas's language. Hopefully, though, just asking this question suffices for an answer. We do have to ask, what is acedia? Because there's something funny about sorrowing over our relationship with God that isn't funny about sorrowing over a sprained ankle or over being tedious. So the second prelude question, how should we go about answering what is acedia? And here we'll recycle our earlier approach. Begin with Tristan, and then look at the causes and then the effects of acedia, and then save the remedies until part three. So, Tristan again. 6 weeks after Tristan's fateful fence jump, we find him up and walking again. He's had plenty of time in a cast, not running, to recover. And although he thinks that he should miss running, since this was the greatest joy of his life, he finds himself in the strange position of not missing it at all. In fact, he finds that whenever he thinks about running, he feels sad. This disturbs him, so he begins to fill his day with non-running activities, with anything that will distract him from the thought of running. The distractions are hard, though, since his whole life and his friends up to that point was built around running. So he tries to convince himself that running was never very good anyway. He begins to sabotage his health, to deliberately get fat and weak, not because he needs to eat Ben and Jerry's and take the car everywhere, but out of anger at his situation. Anything makes sense as long as he can't run. If St. Thomas were given the chance to comment on this anecdote, I think he would begin by expressing his concern at Tristan's rapid decline. After we explain to Thomas that Tristan is just an illustration of acedia, Thomas would probably say that Tristan isn't the clearest illustration of acedia. Acedia is sorrow in response to thinking of our relationship with God. And our friendly relationship with God doesn't show up in the Tristan anecdote. Thomas would then hopefully say that something like friendship with God is present in the anecdote, since Tristan's relationship with running was the greatest thing in his life. So great that he viewed everything else as valuable only if it was either part of or for running. Tristan's experience of sorrowing over the foundational enjoyment of his life parallels the sorrow of acedia. How does this sorrow over our friendship with God come to be? One obvious cause or condition for sorrowing over our friendship with God is we have to be in a friendship with God. What Thomas means by friendship here isn't just believing in God or believing that God loves me, although friendship definitely involves these things. Thomas presents friendship as a particular way of loving. I have what Thomas calls concupiscence love. If I wish to have something, let's call it X, it might be a burger, a good conversation, or a bonfire. I wish to have X, which I perceive to be good for me. And when it's in my power, I act on my wish to have this thing. That's concupiscence love. In contrast to that, I have friendship love when I wish for my friend to have X, which is good for him. And then when it's in my power, I act on my wish to bring it about that my friend has that X, be it a burger, a good conversation, or a bonfire. Friendship love is most complete, however, when you are the thing that is X for your friend, and your friend is one of the things that is X for you. So in a complete friendship, you wish for your friend to have what he desires, and he wishes the same for you. And you experience joy in being with your friend, both because his presence is what you want for yourself, and your presence to him is what you want for him. In this case, eating burgers, having good conversations, and having bonfires aren't the primary sources of joy, but rather they're just occasions for being with your friend. If your friend could be with you in everything, and if there was nothing unloving in your friend and nothing unloving in you, then your friendship would be nothing but a source of joy. But God is with us in everything, and there isn't anything unloving in him. So it seems strange, bordering on impossible, that we should respond to the thought of our friendship with God with sadness. Where does the source of the sorrow enter in? Here's a thought. In addition to having a friendship with God, one of Acedia's conditions is that our thought of that friendship has become distorted in some way. And the distortion makes us associate our friendship with God with some lack of goodness. My guess as to how this happens is something like this. Whenever we think of our friendship with God, we have an image that grounds our ability to think this thought rather than another. The image, or this image, as well as our image for anything, is always drawn from our experience. So, as a brief audience participation thing, think of buffalo wings. And now, think of your image of the buffalo wing. Show of hands, did anyone think of a buffalo? With wings? Anyone think of what looks like a chicken drumstick or a chicken wing? Okay. Anyone think of the word? Just see buffalo wings? Okay. So this is just an indication that we can think something, but then the image that we use to think of that has a kind of a content that's funny enough to laugh at. I have a little bit of a history with buffalo wings where the most violent food poisoning that I ever got was from buffalo wings with great blue cheese dressing at a bar in West Virginia. I wasn't a sister. but I'll say, in addition to the image that I have of buffalo wings, so in other words, when I say buffalo wings, it might be the state of West Virginia that shows up. It's kind of funny, but when someone says West Virginia, I think of buffalo wings and food poisoning. But unfortunately, the thought of a buffalo wing and even the image of a buffalo wing, for me, elicits an emotional response of violent illness, or the fear of the violent illness. So this is not entirely unrelated to Acedia, because the image that we have for our friendship with God, because it is, you could say it's a complex drawn from the various experiences that we've had of prayer, of attending services, of people telling us things, people who might have nice characteristics or not. All of those individual experiences can be sort of drawn in to the image that shows up in us spontaneously whenever we think of our friendship with God. So suppose one of those experiences was something maybe not so violent as food poisoning, but something that was a little unpleasant. This means that when I think of my friendship with God, there's going to be some part of that image that elicits in me an aversive response, something that is not coming directly from what God is, but coming from some undesirable aspect of my experience in struggling through a relationship with God. So just to put some boundaries on what might show up in the image of our relationship with God or our friendship with God, you might have in this image the experience of the physical pain in fasting or the difficulty of getting out of bed and going to Mass. You might have the experience of emotional difficulty in persevering in prayer. Or you might have even the experience of your own lack of agency, like your passivity, your cowardice, your self-reliance. All of that shows up in your friendship with God. Your friendship with God, or the image that you have of it, also might be distorted, not because it has these features that are objectively bad, but also because it doesn't have all of the features that it ought to. So for example, suppose you weren't raised with a very clear or even definite understanding of God, or even how you ought to relate to him or other people. In this case, your friendship with God might be something more of you have a lot of words, but you haven't had the experience of being brought into a relationship with others. You also might have something similar, which is your primary understanding of a friendship of God might be something like a checklist, where you focus on a whole bunch of activities, and you do those for God. But what's missing from your image, your understanding, or maybe not even your understanding, at least your image, is that God is doing this with you. So our image of God that shows up whenever we think of our friendship with God can be distorted either because it has some parts that are unpleasant or because it doesn't have a complete account of the beauty and the joyfulness of a friendship with God. What happens if we unconsciously focus on these bad or missing aspects of the image? We will begin to feel sorrow when we think of our friendship with God. And even if the sorrow isn't coming from the whole experience of our friendship with God, if we're not careful, we can end up attributing to the entire thing the emotional response that we have toward a part. St. Thomas gives us an account of how this initially unconscious response to an unconscious focusing can progress. So we might begin by noticing the evils of our experience of a great good. That's to say, we might begin just by noticing that, gosh, prayer can be awesome, but it also can be really hard. That's involuntary, or it's at least not voluntary to notice things. This can progress, though, if we not merely notice the sort of the unpleasant aspects of a good thing, but if we end up focusing on those unpleasant aspects of a good thing. This is what St. Thomas says is a venial sin. He says the inclination to do this is disordered. He says, but it's not yet voluntary. So he says the inclination to focus on the bad, on the thing that you want to complain about, the thing that brings you sorrow, that inclination is disordered. And what you do, what we can do in response to this, is to consciously turn our attention elsewhere. If we don't do that, however, that inclination to focus on the lesser evil, if we don't turn our attention away, then what we end up doing is confirming that this is what we want to attend to. And it becomes a mortal sin when we consciously permit ourselves to focus on a lesser evil. This is to say, we realize what we're doing and we consent to do it anyway. St. Thomas calls this confirmation of this sort of sensory, this appetite for sensory pleasures. He calls this a mortal sin where the flesh not merely opposes the spirit, but prevails over it. There's even a further progression from venial sin to mortal sin, now here to vice. You could say each time we commit the internal act of focusing, consciously focusing on the bad aspects of a good thing, This strengthens the inclination in us to do it again. And over time, this strong inclination develops in us a habit, which is to say a stable disposition or an ingrained tendency to act in a certain way. Note that even if you never acted externally on what these inclinations are inclining you to do, they would still be bad. There's still a distortion of your attention and of your heart. Why acedia is a sorrow that kills should be evident, but just to put numbers on things, here are two killing effects of acedia. First, acedia distorts our perspective on life as a whole, because our friendship with God is that for which every other activity is done. When the first principle, the highest principle in any system, is distorted, the entire system is distorted. This is because the first principle isn't just the greatest thing in the system, but the first principle is the unity of the system itself. It's the what for of everything else. In comparison with God, we should hate everything else. This is Hebrew hyperbole, meaning that our attraction to things less than God should be far less than our attraction to God. The distortion of the first principle of our system not only affects our perception of God and of the entire system, but also of ourselves particularly. If I am the being who exists to enjoy God, and if God isn't entirely good, then I am the being who is made to rest in evil. That is not an identity that we can sustain. This is why, as the second effect, killing effect of acedia, is what St. Thomas calls the daughters of acedia. The daughters are born from the mother distortion of acedia, and they are symptoms of a life that isn't coherent because its first principle has been distorted. But these daughters are what we do in order to try to save ourselves from the dull, deep, uncomfortable sorrow of a meaningless life. We do some things to try to avoid whatever we believe is causing the sorrow. We flee the thing that we supposedly love, whose presence causes us sorrow. And here, I'll mention four of the daughters. One daughter is despair. So in order to relieve ourselves from sorrowing over an evil that's present, we try to kill the desire for the thing that isn't there. The second is sluggishness or idleness. And this is the absence of desire for what we already possess. This is similar to despair. In both cases, again, it's a lack of love for something that is good, an intentional lack of love for something that's good because we can't tolerate its absence. Another way that we can fight or try to relieve ourselves of the distortion of acedia is to try to fight the thing that we supposedly love. We can do this out of spite or anger. It's almost as though we're trying to get God to push us away. Like we get angry at him in order to try to get him to push us away. And when these three things fail, despair, sluggishness, and then spite, we fall into the almost all purpose. We numb out, ordinarily by making ourselves incredibly busy. What this does is it gives us pleasure from activity where we're lacking it in our friendship with God. None of these attempts at escaping sorrow, of course, are ultimately successful. Take busyness, for example. This only takes away one of the conditions that are necessary for sorrow. Sorrow arises, again, when we have some pain and when we're aware of it. Being busy only takes away our awareness of the pain, but the pain is still there. Part three, what should we do if we find ourselves afflicted with acedia or with non-acedia sorrow? But first, just one prelude question. Is there any way to determine whether we have acedia or not? Since presumably it wouldn't make sense to apply a remedy for an affliction that we don't have. St. Thomas doesn't explicitly ask or answer this question, but I think his reply would be something like this. In a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. No, in that there isn't an easy way to determine whether you have acedia. So here's a list of old and new reasons why an attempt at diagnosing ourselves is at least difficult and probably a waste of time. Number one, we have access to so many pleasures and so many different activities that it's hard for us to know whether we're sorrowful over anything, let alone over our relationship with God. Number two, acedia isn't an external act, it's an internal one, which sometimes, but not always, produces external acts as effects. So we can't look to our external acts to determine whether we have acedia. Three, the daughters of acedia, sluggishness, spite, despair, etc., these aren't unique to acedia. They're always signs that something is bad, but maybe not the bad thing that's identical with acedia. Number four, acedia as a sorrow looks a lot like other sorrows that arise even among those who are striving to be friends with God. So consider the four following situations, each of which we might mistake for acedia. There's the sorrow of the sinner over not being able to eat a hamburger on Friday in Lent. There's the sorrow of the repentant sinner over his sin, which might have been eating meat in Lent. There's three, the sorrow of the saint over not yet seeing God. And then there's the lack of joy of the Carmelite over any sensory or spiritual good other than God himself. But turning to the other side of Thomas's hypothetical reply, yes, there are a few ways we might attempt to determine whether we're experiencing acedia or just plain sorrow. First, we might examine what the sorrow inclines us to do. Remember that acedia is an inclination that produces other inclinations, and the inclinations are there even if you never act on them. So, what is the inclination of the sorrow of the sinner? The sorrow of a sinner might lead to sluggishness and spite and obedience. The sorrow of the repentant sinner might lead to new fervor in fasting. But if the sinner keeps focusing on his sins, it also might lead to sluggishness and despair. The sorrow of the saint will lead to greater longing for God. But that might lead to a neglect of duties and even forgetfulness of them, which might look like sluggishness. And then the lack of joy of the Carmelite might lead to restlessness or to rereading Story of a Soul yet another time. All of these inclinations of non-acedia sorrow could look similar to the inclinations of acedia, with this one very significant exception. Ordinary sorrows incline us to things that could lead to some good, but acedia doesn't incline us to anything good. And it's in this sense that it kills. It doesn't open us to life in any way. A second way we might try to determine whether we're afflicted with acedia is by considering the object of our attention when we experience sorrow. Recall that the sorrow of acedia is over the presence of a real good, namely God. The sorrow of a repentant sinner is over the presence of a real evil, namely sin. The sorrow of a saint is over the absence of a real good. And the lack of joy of the Carmelite is due to the absence of desire for any good other than God himself. This second way would allow you to diagnose your sorrow accurately if you could accurately engage in self-introspection. But most of us are very bad at self-introspection. And even if you happen to be good at it, there's another kind of spectating that's far more important to engage in than this. So, rather than spending your time trying to get an accurate diagnosis, the hypothetical Thomas, that's to say I, would recommend just applying the remedies, which are good even for Carmelites. There are three remedies that Thomas mentions explicitly, and then there are three more that I think Thomas would have mentioned if he'd been writing to a culture of abundance and passivity that makes acedia so easy to fall into and so hard to notice. One of Thomas's remedies is observe the Sabbath. Keeping holy the Sabbath requires that we stop yielding to busyness. Busyness doesn't cause acedia, but it can keep it in place by preventing us from realizing the depth of our sorrow. Resting our bodies and our minds from busyness, that's to say from any activity other than the activity of enjoying God and the people of God, restores our ability to notice, without the influence of haste, what things are. In short, keeping holy the Sabbath prepares us to practice the second remedy, which is contemplation. To contemplate is to allow your attention and your affection to rest on and in God. Contemplation is characterized by a twofold rest. First, the rest of the mind. We're not thinking about God, but just allowing Him to present Himself to us. Second, the rest of the heart. Our desire is so fulfilled that it simply rests. And the rest is so complete that when we're contemplating, we're not even tempted to step outside ourselves and delight in the fact that we're contemplating. And if you are thinking about that, then you're not at the most profound rest of contemplation yet. Contemplation is a remedy for acedia in that it is the rest of which acedia is the mockery. Acedia would have us rest in an undesirable absence. Contemplation supplies for and straightens out this central distortion of acedia, namely the inclination to rest our attention on the evil or unpleasant aspects of our relationship with God. One of the reasons why we might fail to contemplate, even when we know what it is and how to do it, is because we're afraid of taking our attention off of the things in our control. This is why Thomas's third remedy, which is gratitude for God of the things that we experience, is a helpful way to escape the addictive power of fear. In order to be really grateful, and not just say that we're grateful, or think that we should be grateful, we need to rest our attention on the goodness of that for which we're trying to be grateful, and also on the one to whom we're grateful. Concerted attempts at gratitude thus incline us to look for what is really present in each thing, even if we recognize that there also is something really horrid in it. Gratitude also inclines us to see each good thing as a gift from God. And sometimes this is the only thing that we can honestly see. I'll turn now to three remedies that Thomas doesn't mention, but that seem to me to support the three that he does. Each of these unmentioned remedies addresses a different moment in what I'll call the mechanism by which acedia is kept in place. Fasting. Fasting helps us to resist turning to busyness as a means of distracting ourselves from feeling sorrow and then from attending to the image whose distortions cause sorrow. Fasting strengthens us to be able to rest our attention on what's important, even in the presence of other demands. What I mean by fasting isn't just abstaining from food. It means turning away from everything other than God, even productivity and even busy prayers, that would distract us from encountering what is present. Fasting is a way of pushing back against micro-addictions, against our dependency on managing our sorrow rather than addressing it at its root. Fasting is practice in not guarding ourselves from feeling sorrow. Second, human friendship helps to fill out our distorted and incomplete image of the friendship of God. It does this, first, by saving us from the loneliness and the errors of solitary introspection. Since a real friend will be with you in the activities that matter most in life, the friend will be someone beside you, directing his attention and yours to what matters most. And often what matters most is what you don't see. And if the friend is a real friend, he'll see you not seeing what you should see. A second way that human friendship can help to free us from acedia is by giving us an experience of enjoying being with someone. The goodness of this experience isn't that its pleasure distracts us from a sorrow, but that it can fill out and correct the distortions that might have crept into our image of friendship with God. So when you're tempted to think of your friendship with God as a checklist, your experience of delighting in the mere presence of your friend can serve as a corrective. And I think this also serves as a model for prayer, by the way. Rather than focusing on a predetermined set of words, turn to God, who is present in a way that is even more manifest than the way that a friend is present. A third way that human friendship can help to free us from acedia is to provide the context within which it's possible for us to encounter sorrow. Not the sorrow of acedia, but the sorrow over the presence of a real evil, no matter how small. A friend can affirm with me the goodness of the thing that was lost and the painfulness of its absence. A friend can also allow me to stop trying to cling to the good thing that I've lost by being present to me. At a certain point, I'll realize that my attending to the thing that I've lost is preventing me from enjoying the thing that I haven't lost. All this is to say, human friendship gives us practice in the third remedy for acedia, which I'll call surrendering to sorrow. To surrender to sorrow means to stop fleeing and fighting our experiences of pain, and to stop distracting ourselves from our awareness of pain. In the stillness of not fighting and not fleeing, we allow ourselves to recognize the goodness of the thing that's lost, and then to let ourselves feel its loss. This is tolerable for us only if there's something greater that we haven't lost and in which we can take delight. Suppose Tristan is filled with sorrow over the loss of his reputation as a runner. He can let this go. To say he can stop trying to regain his reputation only if he can allow himself to delight in something greater, like being loved by a friend. Surrendering to sorrow, in other words, allows us to metabolize the pain that we've experienced. And it's in this sense that sorrow can save. Surrendering to sorrow over a real evil is the solution to the problem of acedia, which is the problem of sorrowing over a real good. Surrendering to sorrow saves us from being driven by fear and anger and from a life of superficiality, that's to say, a life spent in pursuit of numbing distractions. Surrendering to sorrow doesn't merely save us from a life filled with superficial pleasures. It also carves out in us a space for deeper joys. Pain draws our attention to our capacity to be affected by what's real. When we allow ourselves to rest our attention on this capacity, our desire to be filled with what is good increases. Another way of saying this is that we experience joy and sorrow in the same part of the soul, in the part of us that does nothing but desire what is good. To be alert to this desire through sorrow increases our alertness to its fulfillment and delight. Similarly, it's only to the extent that we allow ourselves to be pierced by the goodness of things that we're able to sorrow deeply when the thing is absent. I'll close by pointing to someone whose life was a constant remedy for acedia, even though she was preserved from acedia to the end. Because her application of these remedies wasn't in any way tainted by acedia itself, she can be for us both a model and a friend. Scripture tells us that Mary's heart was pierced by a sword. She experienced profound sorrow because she kept her heart unguarded. Scripture also tells us that Mary kept all these things in her heart. She was able to keep them in her heart and yet stand at the foot of the cross, precisely because her way of keeping them wasn't to hold on to them, but to let herself be pierced by them, and to let herself be held by God. Mary shows us that all of our sorrows can be means to a deeper sharing of our hearts with God. Mary shows us that to the extent that we open our hearts to allow God to share in our sorrow, God will open his heart to allow us to share in his joy. Because Mary's heart was open to the heart of God, his heart was opened to and through her. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.